You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate today. In 1971, the U.S. government declared war on cancer. In the 40 years since, researchers have worked to develop more effective treatments to battle the disease. But if anything, cancer rates are rising, and it remains the second leading cause of death in America. Clifton Leaf looks into why we're so far from winning the war on cancer in his book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It, which is published by Simon & Schuster. He's also a guest editor for the New York Times op-ed page and Sunday Review, and I'm pleased to welcome Clifton Leaf to the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You started this research in 2004. You were writing an article for Fortune magazine, and you jumped into it thinking what everybody had thought, which is that cancer, that we're beating the war on cancer.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I thought we were going through the same kind of miraculous transformation that we'd made in other diseases. And I had had this late night scotch with the CEO of a drug company named Novartis. And the CEO, Dan Vasella, was describing this drug called Gleevec, which was this magical drug that targeted a specific gene mutation that caused a certain cancer. And this was the future that I had learned was coming, you know, that there were all sorts of drugs in development that were following this same sort of flight pattern, if you will. It was only after I started to look at the numbers, how many people were getting the disease and how many people were dying of it, that I started to sense a different story was emerging.
And what was the reaction from that initial article in 2004?
Well, very surprisingly, I thought I was going to get, you know, first I thought it was going to be ignored because it was a story about cancer in Fortune magazine, which is a magazine about business. But there was a tremendous response. And what was perhaps most exciting for me was this idea that people in the community, cancer researchers and doctors, wanted to welcome me into a conversation, a global conversation. And that came right away. People were saying, hey, you got, you know, some of this right, but you got some of it wrong, and let's talk about it.
How much did you actually know about medicine and the science behind cancer before you started this journey of both the book and your own treatment as well?
I knew absolutely nothing. I had actually failed a high school biology class. slept through whatever science training that I'd gotten in college. And so, you know, I was a total naive in this. But I think one of the strengths that I was able to bring this was the courage to be able to ask really stupid questions.
I've made a career of that.
Yeah. I don't know if it's courage or stupidity, but whatever it was, I was able to just go out there and say, listen, hey, I don't understand this. You're saying that this is all the progress we're making, but I'm looking at these black and white numbers here, and they're going the wrong way. And I do want to say one thing. Some of the rates are actually going in the right direction, but the raw numbers are going in the wrong direction. And part of how we tell the story of cancer has to do with those rates. So that they can sometimes paint a misleading picture.
If you can, briefly, and I know it's a lot of statistics, but as simply as possible, the basic thesis is that it's growing.
Yeah. I mean,
the rate of deaths.
The burden of cancer is going. And not so much the rate of death, but the numbers, the raw numbers are going up because we have an aging society and a growing society. And those numbers have gone down a little bit in recent years, but they're still up from where they were when we began the war on cancer 40 years ago.
And basically that, you know, it's basically a placard and a rallying cry when people say war on cancer. Are you flat out saying we're losing that war?
You know, I think we're losing the war because we are because of three reasons. We really still follow the wrong strategy, and I'll get to that in a minute. We have systems that are also focused on getting researchers to share along the same platforms and to work for the same common goals. And those systems don't work. And the third reason, I think, is this issue of straightforwardness and accountability. All of that is driven by a failure in the cancer culture, this culture of cancer research and treatment. And I think that that culture reinforces some of these shortcomings, and that's really what this book is about, is, you know, how did we get here? How did this culture form? You know, why is it not working and how do we break out of it?
Well, let's start with how we got here, maybe from the 1971 National Cancer Act signed by President Nixon. What was that exactly?
So this was interesting. I mean, President Nixon was pretty much forced into this, not only by advocates in the community, people were very, very concerned about rising death rates. And that, at that time, the rates were, in fact, rising, and incidence rates was rising even more dramatically. But also by Senator Kennedy, a Democrat, who was getting ready legislation in Congress. And so he was, I think, tried to get ahead of the game and grab onto a very, very popular issue.
Did something about that act sort of set in place some of the barriers that we're still dealing with today?
Well, there were two bills, and I write about this in the book, that there were two bills. One of the bills was going to separate out the cancer effort into its own agency, and there was a lot of criticism about that. But it also had some merit because it was able to take it out into a different kind of engineered project. The other bill basically just gave cancer more money. And that's really where we've been ever since. We've just keep adding to the cancer research budget, and in the private sector is adding its own research dollars, and the marchers and pink ribbon wearers and the rest of us, including me. I've worked for cancer charities before. We keep giving to that effort as well. So there's lots of money going into it. It's just not being used in the right way.
And I guess the intent was good, the Cancer Act. I mean, it came out of a time where we had heard President Kennedy challenge us to go to the moon and come back. Mm-hmm. We should be able to conquer cancer the same way.
Yeah, I do think that aspirational aspect is good. That aspirational aspect has been criticized quite a lot because many scientists, I think rightfully in some cases, said, listen, we don't know a lot about this. You know, there were some scientists saying, well, at least when we sent a man to the moon, we knew what the laws of gravity were. We didn't really have that sense that we understood the cancer process very well. But I think that that naysaying there, the feeling that we couldn't solve a problem because we didn't understand it, actually it was a little off base because we've solved many problems that we don't fully understand, or at least we've made progress against them.
You start the book by telling the story of Jo-Hin Chio. Tell us what he discovered.
So Jo-Hin Chio is a remarkable character, and he discovered the correct number of human chromosomes. And what was interesting was this was in the 1950s. He was working at a late night in a lab in Sweden, and he came across this correct number, that there were 46 chromosomes, 23 pairs. And it had contradicted the gospel, the dogma that there were 48 chromosomes that had been in all the textbooks. And there was this great cytogeneticist named Cyril Darlington, and he was the guy that wrote this. And there was even a picture in a textbook which actually had 46 chromosomes, but the caption said 48. And so everybody believed there were 48, and here's this guy that sees 46. And he does the test again and again and again. And after he reveals this and the story is published, lots of people came over to him and said, you know, and they sent letters, listen, we also saw 46, but we were so afraid to say anything because it went against that, you know, the belief. And so
that's
like
crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And yet this is what was happening with cancer as well. Many people, especially after in the first years of the war on cancer and then into the 80s, people were saying, wow, you know, we're really making progress and this is great. And there were a couple of people saying, no, that's just not what the numbers show. And that's not what these researchers were experiencing in their own practice and not what doctors were experiencing in their own, you know, treatment of patients.
I'm Elliot Forrest, here today for Leonard Lopate, talking with Clifton Leaf, the author of the book Truth in Small Doses. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. This, of course, is not completely academic for you. You were diagnosed with Hodgkin's at the age of 15.
Yes.
And survived with a chemotherapy regimen. How are you today?
Chemo and radiation. So far, well, you know, just it's been a long time, but you never really get out of that feeling like you're in that your treatment, your success is somehow held in escrow. You know, you're always feeling every lymph node that comes on. You can't help it. I think that's the experience for many patients, and part of what we have to think about as the cancer burden. I also, you know, point out to people that, you know, it's the the height of gall to be, you know, sitting here as the beneficiary of great cancer science and through clinical trials at the NCI, at the National Cancer Institute. Through the great care of many, I'm sitting here to criticize this, to criticize the war on cancer.
Noted that you're taking both sides.
Yes, appreciate that.
Would the regimen for you today be the same as it was when you were 15?
Probably not. I had a treatment called MOP, which was an ingenious treatment. It was the first real synergistic treatment of drugs since the acute lymphocytic leukemia, which was ALL, the childhood cancer that's most common. And this was designed by a team at the NCI. Dr. Vince DeVita was the leader of this team. There were others, including a guy named Bruce Chabner, who ended up taking care of me when I was at the NCI. But there are newer treatments, combinations of drugs that would be most likely to be used. I also had radiation treatment as well, and that has evolved a little bit over time.
Do you think you would have written this book about cancer and where we are today if you hadn't been a survivor yourself?
You know, I think about that a lot. I fancy myself as someone who was, you know, as someone who was thinking about the numbers here when I first began it, as, you know, approaching this as a business writer and editor. I had this notion that you know, this was in some ways like a Wall Street story where you had the rhetoric coming, you know, saying how well things were doing. And then you look at the numbers, the financial statements, you know, how many people were getting the disease, how many were dying of it, what we were spending on treatment each year. And those two were not jibing. And when I was at Fortune, I ran the investing coverage. And this was in some ways like reminiscent of those dot-com days where, you know, companies were saying, oh, don't look at how much we're making. Just look at the eyeballs and the stickiness of our websites. And that was the kind of rhetoric that was happening, except instead of stickiness and eyeballs, it was advances and breakthroughs and discoveries and all of this kind of press that's generated in the course of the medical publishing world. So I looked at it that way. And it was only later when my great editor, Rick Kirkland, said, listen, hey, you got to talk about you. You know, you got to talk about your own experience here. So I'm glad I did.
You're right in the book, it's a story without villains, and I'm not going to place the villainous role onto any of these organizations, but you're also pretty clear that these numbers seem to come out from government agencies, from private cancer societies, and then it's celebrated by the media that it's going down. How do you really track where the problem comes from that we're in this PR situation that seems like cancer is decreasing when it's not?
Elliot, I think that's the best question. That really drives to the heart of what the challenge of this is, because I really struggled. I interviewed or spoke with, many of them were just sort of hallway conversations at conferences, but well over 1,000 people. And in that, I don't think I found one person who my sense was wouldn't give their right arm or lose their home if they felt they could find a cure for some type of cancer, myriad cancers that are out there. People really were focused on at least the right goal, but it was the day-to-day stuff that was getting them focused on the wrong things. And so what became the dream at night became the rules of the day job. And so that's where that culture came in. I don't think that overarching personal greed has played a role in this. I think that corporate greed to some extent may have, and I think that, that money certainly is driving the wrong incentives. But it is one of the challenges, figuring out how is something broken when none of the people themselves are broken.
Or even think it's broken.
Yeah.
As a society. I'm speaking with Clifton Leaf, a guest editor for the New York Times op-ed page and Sunday Review, about his book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer, which is published by Simon & Schuster. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate today. My guest is Clifton Leaf. His book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. You tell the story in your book, Clifton, about Brian Quinlan and his family. He was diagnosed with a form of leukemia at the age of four.
Mm-hmm.
What was the lesson there?
Well, I think I'm still learning all the lessons from the Quinlan family. I mean, they're the most inspirational group of people I've met in this process. I met them down at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. By the way, it's an amazing place. And they had come there in large part from luck. Nancy Quinlan, the mother, had recognized that her son wasn't feeling well. He would wake up in the middle of the night with these, screaming from pain, he'd had this terrible nightmare, but he wasn't a nightmare. He was, would double over in pain. They went to check him out a couple of times. Doctors sort of poo-pooed it, thought it was constipation, thought it was psychological. But Nancy had this sense, a mom sense, of that her son was sick. And she went looking for a specialist, a gastroenterologist. And it was only through her perseverance that she found the right guy and had him diagnosed early enough so that he could go and get treatment right away. And it's an incredibly brutal treatment. It's one of our great success stories, but at the same time, that treatment is so brutal that it's hard not to think of it as part of the cancer burden. And so that's one of the challenges here is where how do you take something that's an absolute success? We went from zero survival rate to almost 90%. And how do you look at that and say, well, what can we do to make this better?
Can you break it down? Are we doing better? Are there less diseases? Are less deaths, if that's the measure we're looking at, an overall death rate for leukemia, for breast cancer, for example?
Well, it's interesting. The death rates for these diseases are going down, and the survival is inching up. But what we look at is five-year survival, is five-year relative survival. So someone who dies at 6 years after a battle of cancer is counted as a success story. So it's very, very difficult to look at these statistics in their sort of pure form.
Well, in that case, like Elizabeth Edwards.
She is a success
story. She's a success.
She is.
She's not with us anymore.
Exactly. But she's a five-year survivor, so she would go under the the percentages of survivors. This is one of the challenges is that cancer is hundreds of diseases. In fact, arguably, as I just wrote a piece in the New York Times this Sunday, it's really hard to not think of each of these diseases as diseases of one. They're really individual when you look at the genetic breakdown and the epigenetic breakdowns that happen, the breakdowns apart from sort of gene mutations or changes in order. So I think that's one of the challenges of this disease or these diseases compared with others. But still, when you look at the whole totality of cancer, it's hard to say that we're really making the kind of progress that we've made with other diseases. And I'll give you an example. If you separate out cancer as a cause of death and you look at every other cause of death together, every other, and you measure the crude rate of death over time, that crude rate has dropped about 24% since 1970, from 1970 to 2010. For cancer, the crude rate of death over that time has risen 14%. So take everything other than cancer, has dropped 24%. For cancer alone, up 14%. So when you look at it in that totality, it's easier to see the sort of contrast with our success against other diseases. When you look at it at a more microcosm level and you see, we're learning this and that about each cancer and we are making incremental improvements, some more than others in certain cancers, then it's hard to sort of dismiss all of that with one sweeping hand and say, we're not making progress. And so I try not to do that in the book. I think there's a difference between not making progress and between making little bits of progress and winning. And that's really where I try to drive that book, this book.
You write in the book that the advancements that we have made target very little problems, often without looking for the big breakthroughs. I guess you're just hopeful that those are out there if we just sort of what, shift our thinking?
Hmm. Well, I mean, you sort of don't know what you don't know. This is one of the great challenges. It's certainly the great challenge and I think danger of being a critic in any sense is that, oh, you know, who does this guy think he is? And you know, you have to, you know, accept that. I think that when you look at the systems that don't work, then you start to understand how broken this really is. And so really when you're designing any kind of effort against anything, you want the different pieces to work together. And so I write about how early in the space program, you know, there was this complete breakdown in the Ranger program, and where there was absolutely no management, no coordination of the various parts. Everybody was a genius that worked at them out of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. But, you know, for the most part, nobody knew, the left hand didn't know what the right hand is doing. And we see that very, very much in the cancer effort. And the systems that are designed to help researchers share don't work. You know, we don't have a system for allowing researchers to get access to biospecimens, to tumor specimens on which they can, you know, do their research and understand this molecular basis of cancer.
You stress in your book this need for management, but is that a private thing? Is that a governmental agency? Where would you ideally see this overarching management come from?
Well, I think that the different parts that are managed by different aspects. So, for example, I think that the part that is managed by the federal government, the NCI, ought to be managed better. The private aspects can work quite well. I mean, for example, in semiconductors, one of the people that really informed the story was Andy Grove, the legendary one of the co-founders of Intel and a longtime CEO of that great company. And you know, he pointed out that in semiconductor industry, you know, there are consortiums that allow people to do some of the sort of non-competitive investments in research that help create common platforms. We are able to create networks, for example, at a private level in everything we do. You know, imagine eBay. In 4 years, what eBay was able to do in the first 4 years, I can't remember the exact number, but, you know, tens of thousands of transactions because someone created a common system.
Right. The internet. And changed retail by doing it.
Yeah, the internet. I mean, it's a common protocol. So you have all these disparate elements using a common protocol and a common language and a common set of rules for engaging with each other. And that's how it works.
So basically you're calling for crowdsourcing the cure.
Oh, sure.
I'll make the T-shirt, I think.
Yeah.
You served for 3 years on the National Board of Directors for the Susan G. Komen for the Cure.
I did.
What role do you see those kind of organizations play?
I think very, very important roles. I mean, I got a lot of inspiration from working with the Komen Group, from marching with Komen volunteers. I think it's a great organization. I think that the founder, Nancy Brinker, has been a moving inspiration to me personally. And I think that I can say that about lots of charities. Doug Ullman at Livestrong has been an amazing, forward thinker. Kathy Giusti at the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation is probably the most business-like cancer genius that I know. She has been able to do remarkable things with getting, you know, with developing drug development consortiums, with getting those tumor specimens that I talked about. And so I think this kind of leadership from the outside is really where maybe even the future lies in cancer.
I'm Elliot Forrest here today for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Clifton Leaf, author of the book The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. I'm hoping to get to the win it part before I let you go. In the op-ed piece in the New York Times, you questioned the efficacy of clinical trials. Break that down for us.
Well, the process of clinical trials involves lots and lots of patients. So you have to start with the patients themselves. These are volunteers. These are sick people in the realm of cancer, for example. In other clinical trials, there are healthy volunteers. But in cancer clinical trials, you have to have the participation of lots and lots of very sick people who are hoping against hope for something that's going to work. And I think they get good care in clinical trials, those that are completed anyway. But 40% of those who, that are NCI run, that are cooperative group trials, don't actually accrue enough patients to finish. And so the patients that are in those trials are actually sort of abandoned mid-process because the trial never fully accrues, and so they can't actually go and test the drugs or whatever the treatment that they were testing. And so you have these different types of trials. The ones that are sponsored by drug companies are when there is a big effect, they know it early. So in the case of Gleevec, this miracle drug against a disease called CML, chronic myeloid leukemia, it's a great drug. It really is. They knew in phase one that it was a great drug in the first dose ramping studies. They knew in phase two, they did three of those, and they knew right away that this was a major, major drug. And so, in fact, it was approved on the basis of that. But most of what we do, we go through phase one and we don't see any effect. We see phase two and we don't see any effect. And then, hope against hope, these drug companies put it into phase three, hoping that they're going to see some statistically significant, but not clinically significant effect. And that's really where the game is, because if they get an approval for that drug, it can be billions of dollars. And we've seen this time and time again. I don't want to pick on anybody right now, but this is the game. And researchers themselves know it. There are criteria within the clinical trials that exclude patients who may be too sick or too old or have been too overtreated already. The inclusion criteria as well can be engineered so that the treatment arms get a better effect than the comparator arms. And so it's really a broken system.
And I know there's billions of dollars at stake for pharma, but for the average person listening, when we hear about these clinical trials, we fall into two camps usually.
Yeah.
It's like, why don't they do it faster so that we can get these drugs to us?
Yes.
And why are they releasing them so fast? Because they have all these side effects.
It's true. I wrote a piece about this for Fortune years ago called Deadly Caution, and it looked at this sort of difficulty where you have, drugs that aren't safe getting out on the market and yet people clamoring to get these things out there. And part of the problem is that our clinical trials don't really give us a complete sense of whether these drugs are safe anyway. I think they do to some extent allow us to see obvious toxicities, but given this sort of variability in human beings, it's all the harder to imagine what the drug is going to be like in someone with this type of physiology or another. So, in the period of 2000 to 2010, 16 novel medicines, those are what are called new molecular entities, were withdrawn from the market. These were approved medicines withdrawn because of safety reasons. The only way people figure that out wasn't through the clinical trials process, but in the real sort of marketplace of medicine.
Are there cancer clusters in America? Are you likely to get cancer in one part of the country more than the other?
This is one of those great debates out there. People who believe in it swear there are. People who look at the numbers are more doubtful on some. I don't really know enough about that to be able to sort of venture an opinion. But I do think that there are a lot of questions that we aren't able to answer on an epidemiological level, in part because of the sort of failure of this culture, because what we have is all these little small groups working separately. And so you never get the sort of statistical power to do a big epidemiological study. You just get lots and lots of little shards of evidence that don't really point to an answer, but leave sort of tantalizing clues about that. There's this chemical called 2,4-D, which is a weed killer. And for years, decades, people have thought that this drug was somehow related to the cancer process. But after dozens of epidemiological studies, it's hard to sort of point the finger because it leads, in some cases, certain cancers go up. In some cases, other cancers go up. In some cases, there's a dose-response relationship where the more 2,4-D you get the more cancer you get. In some cases, there isn't. So we just don't know.
The title of your book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. Let's talk about how to win it. You think we should be focusing on the earliest stages of cancer's presence, right? Why?
Yeah. I mean, cancer is a process, not an event. And we reflexively think of it as an event. We reflexively think that it starts the moment Mr. Smith goes into the doctor's office and the doctor says, "I'm sorry to tell you, but the scan came back." Or Mrs. Jones comes in. And that's the moment where the clock starts. It's where the clock starts for survival. It's where the clock starts for treatment. It's where the clock starts for insurance reimbursement, etc. But it's really a process. And we have to learn from the lessons of heart disease and everywhere else where we've made some progress. We don't think of heart disease as starting with the heart attack on the golf course or in the DMV or wherever people get heart attacks. We think of this as a long building process, decades in the making, in which people get progressively sicker, but we don't necessarily see it. Some of it is silent. So the arteries start to clog and the hypertension builds. And these are the sort of precursors for heart disease. So Dr. Mike Sporn, who really began to think about this back in the 60s and 70s, identified, really doesn't even talk about it as cancer. He just calls it carcinogenesis as a process. And so that's the challenge, is for us to intervene earlier in that process of carcinogenesis, a process that may take decades, and recognize cancer in its sort of formative stage when it can be most likely treated.
We only have about a minute left. You write in your book about fighting cancer isn't one of medical science, but one of engineering. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's the medical science in terms of the research, but I think the engineering is about trying to establish goals, to manage them, and to get these various groups who are so different with such different backgrounds to work together. That's an engineering challenge. It's something that people like Andy Grove at Intel, which, you know, does phenomenal feats of science, manages to pull off. It's what our businesses in America do so brilliantly, and we've got to treat cancer that same way.
And I know there's a lot of different kinds of cancers. Are you optimistic we'll find a cure?
No, not a cure. I think we'll find some treatments for many cancers, and we have continued to do that. But there is no cure. This is, I think, looking for a cure is a mistake. Cure will come early in cancers when they are, to some extent, less evolved.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks for coming in. I've been speaking with Clifton Leaf, a former guest editor for the New York Times op-ed page and Sunday Review, about his new book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Again, thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much for having me, Elliot.